Hello and welcome to the Ride Fast Take Chances podcast, coming to you from the luxuriously important yet not overly ostentatious Jalopy Shop Studios in the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area, California. You're here with me, Fish, and my amazing, fantastic co-host, Carrie Doherty. Hello, Carrie.
You flatter me too much, Fish.
We are here as citizens of the motorcycle community to applaud those who are doing good, laugh at the stereotypes that fail us, and strengthen the bond that is life on two wheels.
I don't know, Fish. That last part sounded a bit cheesy.
I'm kind of a cheesy guy. My name is Fish. To that end, I guess because I am who I am, I'd like to start with just giving everyone a definition of those stereotypes that I so lovingly hold on to about the motorcycling community. I'm going to start this because my personal favorite current motorcycle stereotype has to be the adventure rider. The adage goes, how do you be an adventure rider? Well, you buy a motorcycle the size of a baby rhinoceros. You then cage that baby rhinoceros. Then you mount tamale carts to the side of that baby rhinoceros. And then you ride it around the city standing up. So that is the adventure rider. How about you, Carrie? Your favorite?
I'd have to say my favorite one would be the hipster, where flannel and three-quarter helmets are king. Jawline is only temporary. And
we, Carrie and myself, are both fans of full gear. It's just what we do. It's who we are. I don't actually care what gear you wear. Be comfortable. Be happy. I hope you make it home, and I hope everything's okay at the end of the day.
I agree with Fish. And for my own style, I honestly like to pull bits and pieces from every type of stereotype. I do like mixing of styles.
You mean like those fantastic motorcycle jeans you're wearing now?
You mean the leggings? They're leggings.
Ooh, pardon me. I will say your boots are quite fashionable.
Yes, these were custom made in San Francisco proper by Al's Attire.
I've actually never heard of them.
Oh, they're fantastic. They make custom made clothes. They make custom shoes. So these were made specifically for my feet. They did the measurements. I picked out what color leather I wanted. I picked out the style. I picked out the height, everything. I would get another pair. Actually, I need another pair. I've worn these to death.
How do you wear boots to death? I mean, I wear my work boots to death, but are those work and riding or?
They're work and riding and life. I pretty much wear these shoes every day for the past 2 years.
Yeah, I find I bond with my moto gear too. I currently have the same pair of Aerostitch combat touring boots that I have had probably going on 12 years now. They don't see daily life. They only see moto life, but I am a fan of them as well. I'm a fan of pretty much everything Aerostitch, so do with that information what you will. So these hipsters, you live in San Francisco proper, right?
I do. I live in San Francisco proper.
So being there, I feel like I'm not going to say San Francisco is the epicenter for hipsterdom, because I'm sure everyone who's listening is going to send us emails and tell us that their place is the epicenter for hipsters. But do you have any particular tales or tales of woe living around there and being around the hipsters?
I honestly feel like it's not as bad out here as it was back east.
Where's back east?
I lived in Baltimore for about 10 years, and everybody wanted a cafe racer and the three-quarter helmet and the cool red wing shoes and just jeans and flannel to go with this style to look cool. Was it to look cool? I mean, it looks kind of cool, but it's not quite. I'm utilitarian in my life.
So I am too. Like when I, in my younger years, before I realized there was specialized motorcycle gear, I wore jeans and a t-shirt and work boots. I rode them to ride, and I rode them when I wasn't riding a bike. It was just kind of what I wore. So I am now ashamed at the amount of miles I have ridden in a t-shirt. And I think up until I was 22, I actually had half helmets and three-quarter helmets because they were the helmets that my dad bought for me. And that's just what you wore.
I was really lucky. When I first got into riding, the partner I was with at the time was an avid motorcyclist. and wouldn't let me on his motorcycle without having full gear head to toe. And his first gift to me was a Scorpion helmet. I think his second gift to me was a Revit jacket.
Wow.
He worked at a dealership. He did get them at cost, so.
Still, a Revit? That's a good jacket.
It's a great jacket. I still have it. It's their summer jacket from probably 8 years ago.
That's pretty awesome. I grew up in Oregon, and when I moved to the Bay Area, I went for a very long time without riding motorcycles, and I finally, the first motorcycle that got me back into motorcycling was a Kawasaki KZ750 Twin, which was a cafe racer with Clubman bars and a cafe racer tail. And the first piece of motorcycle gear I bought when I moved here was an Alpine Stars Model 101 jacket, which was not sport bike cut. It was more cut relaxed, designed to be part of their Black Label street and motorcycle series clothing. So I totally fell into that trap. I was gifted an HJC full face helmet, and it was really comfortable, and I really liked that helmet a lot. Like, I understand that there's just simply an aesthetic that goes with a bike. I get shit from a lot of people when I ride Harleys wearing Aero Stitches. I kind of just don't care anymore.
That's my favorite. I want to see Harley riders wearing Aero Stitches and adventure riders wearing leather chaps. That's what makes me happy.
So there is actually, in the town I live here, I live in the East Bay area of the San Francisco Bay Area. We have a guy who frequently rides around town on a BMW RT wearing a half helmet, jeans, and a Harley shirt.
Yes.
So, yeah, I always love the crossing of the styles, as one would call it.
There was a guy at the Touratech rally this past June who, I think he had a Honda Rebel, something not standard adventure, and he had a 3/4 helmet and a really old either wax cotton jacket or busted ass leather jacket and a milk crate on the back. And it just made me very happy to see that.
That's motorcycling at its finest. Oh, and wax cotton. I also own a wax cotton suit. It is probably, I got it brand new, and when I put it on, it felt like I had owned it for 20 years. And now that I've owned it for 2 years, I feel like I've still owned it for 20 years. It's so, so unbelievably comfortable.
How is that safety wise?
Better than a t-shirt.
That's easy.
My suit is an Aero Stitch suit, and if you look on their website, they give sort of a crash analysis. Like, if you crash at this many miles per hour, it's going to cost you this much to repair the damage. And I think they say the suit is totaled at like anything over a 35 mile an hour crash, which is, I think, 10 miles an hour slower than their ballistic nylon suit is, quote, totaled at. But I mean, the amount of slide, I can't honestly say, like, that's one of the things about motorcycle gear, even leathers. There's no two sets of leathers will wear identically in a crash because you're not going to slide and have the same hot spots. It does still have armor, and it does still have padding in the areas it needs to have padding. So I feel comfortable and secure in it. And I also, one thing I'd noticed about gear is the more comfortable I am on the bike, the better I am at riding it, which I think to some extent lessens my thought of a crash. I mean, I'm not going to stand on that hill or anything, but sort of in the back of my mind.
Well, and also the more comfortable you are and the more you're visually attracted to the gear, the more likely you are to wear it. So even if one piece of gear might be more protective than something else, I think if you're more comfortable in something that might be less protective, in terms of how it fits and how it looks, go with what you're going to wear and not necessarily what's going to sit in the closet.
What? You mean gear in my closet doesn't protect me when I crash? You can't see my stupid face I'm making now.
News alert.
I did get Carrie to smile with it, though. That was something. Oh, man. Motorcyclists are such, we are such a fickle group.
So are we just going to sit around the garage and complain about shit for the whole podcast?
I mean, you're not wrong. That's sort of my MO. Now, what to expect on this podcast? Honestly, tangents. Subjects will be changed. Feelings will be hurt. Feet will be inserted firmly into mouths. I hope you, if you're not ready for that, this is not the podcast for you. At this point, you can probably, you know, hit pause. Nice to know you. But feelings will be hurt. And if you can't kind of dust it off and take things in stride, then definitely we're not the podcast for you. We're going to make fun of everyone, and everyone is going to make fun of us, because I think anyone who takes motorcycling so seriously that a couple people talking into microphones can hurt your feelings, you're somehow getting it wrong.
I think that's great life advice in general.
I mean, theoretically, yes. I like being happy, and I don't like caring too much about what other people think. So anyways, the other thing to expect on this podcast is adventures. As a matter of fact, Carrie just returned from an adventure. Please tell us about it.
I did. So I run a motorcycle tour company called Motobird Adventures, and we just had a tour down in Baja. It was a week-long tour. The goal was to go to San Ignacio Lagoon and see the baby gray whales.
Whales, you say?
Whales. This time of year is when the gray whales are arriving to Baja. I guess they start coming in January. And they go to, there's a few lagoons on the Pacific coast side of Baja. They're UNESCO World Heritage Sites, so they're protected. The only people who can go out on boats in these areas are the local fishermen who know the area and know how to interact with the animals in the area in a safe way. This was the earliest I've ever actually gone down to go see the gray whales. So we didn't see many babies. We saw one baby, and it was 2 or 3 days old, and it was pretty small.
Like, how small is pretty small? Are we talking like a BMW GS with side cases? Or are we talking like a Honda Monkey or like a Fiat 500?
I'd say, I'm looking around the garage to find something to compare it to.
Let's start with like bigger than a car, smaller than a car.
Small car.
Small car, okay.
Size of a small car.
All right, so like Tesla Model 3, Honda Fit kind of size? Yep, you're drawing a blank.
I'm drawing a blank. Cars. I don't know cars.
Fine. Small car. We're going to go with small car. Okay.
And the really cool thing is apparently...
This is going to be good.
Apparently, they're like sponges. So when they're born, they're super compressed. And then it's like you add water and they grow.
Really? So, subject change. Do you know what a sponge monkey is?
What is it? I don't.
The sponge monkey was a character in a Quiznos commercial, and they were weird and obnoxious and sang terrible songs. And before they were in the Quiznos commercials, they were in a YouTube series. It was a gentleman's creation. I don't remember his name, and I'm not giving him credit, and I'm a terrible person for that. But when you said sponge whale, I thought sponge monkey. So at some point, the sponge monkeys are now going to come up on this podcast. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you. I will have to now look up sponge monkeys.
Yes. So sponge whales.
Sponge whales. So the 3-day-old whale was pretty small in comparison to what I've seen in the past. And also is very interesting because the mother was more protective of the baby at this point in time. If I've seen whales that are about 2 weeks old, and at that point, the mothers are actually bringing them up to the small boats that we're in and pushing, getting underneath the babies and pushing them up to the boat so that we can interact with them and the babies can interact with us.
That sounds utterly epic.
It's incredible. So incredible.
Wow.
They feel like wet eggplants.
Not the kind of eggplants you're thinking of, internet world.
So this time around, because we went earlier in the season, we only saw the one baby, but we did see quite a few other gray whales. They don't interact with the boat as much at this point in time. I kind of got the vibe that they just were arriving and they're trying to settle. And I think some of the whales are obviously still pregnant. So
is this like a whale camp out?
Yeah, I think it's Burning Man for whales.
Burning Man. Okay.
So, a lot more sex, though. I think a lot more sex and babies at the whale Burning Man.
I mean, there's a lot of sex at Burning Man.
I think there's probably more sex at Burning Man. I don't think that there's as many whales as burners. I think there's more burners than whales at this point.
Yes, but I mean, interesting question. And we could do the math on this. Burning Man is theoretically 70,000 participants, I think, at this point. And whatever 70,000 people versus what percentage is that is versus the population of the world, however many whales, what percentage of the whale population is in that location at that time?
Oh, I think it's 100%. I think it's 100%. I would have to look that up. I don't know.
Because that would make it bigger than Burning Man.
Okay. Well, and are we going based on numbers or based on mass? Because I think the whales have the people beat.
Yeah. I mean, boy, God, we could go way off on this.
Yeah. So
welcome to your tangents. Welcome to your tangents, everyone.
So it was a really incredible day out on the water. It was very sunny and beautiful. A lot of the Baja trip was a little chilly and overcast. I was definitely glad to have my heated gloves with me.
Oh, yeah. Heated gloves.
And I also had the opportunity to give my new Honda a shakedown.
Oh, yeah. There's that whole new motorcycle thing.
Whole new motorcycle.
Carrie comes to us from the world of the currently BMW GS650, F650 GS Dakar, excuse me.
Get that right.
Her particular bike is kitted out quite nicely. You can tell us about it. Inverted forks, are they?
Yeah, the front end is a YZ250.
Okay.
The owner before me had a CNC machine, so he made a couple of cool little parts for it.
I love, I am a fan of your giant flat luggage rack.
Oh my God, it's incredible. It's great.
Are there pictures of that on our Instagram?
There will be.
Okay, awesome. Speaking of which, our Instagram is The Real Ride Fast Take Chances. Look it up. It's small in comparison now. It's going to grow bigger as these adventures happen.
What's the fake Real Ride Fast Take Chances?
I don't know if that's available. So The Real Ride Fast Take Chances has an interesting story. Carrie and I both come from a motorcycle magazine called City Bike, which has since moved onward into motorcycle journalism history. Long live City Bike. This Ride Fast Take Chances was City Bike's tagline. And at one point, Roland Sands was making t-shirts that said Ride Fast Take Chances. But City Bike had that tagline since 1984. Thus, way establishing it before Roland Sands. I don't know about the trademark wars or any of that. We are actually licensed to use that per the owner of City Bike, who is in our my dear friend Serge Gish, who will join us at some point in this podcast. But to that end, Serge developed The Real Ride Fast Take Chances as an Instagram hashtag to combat those who were simply hashtagging things Ride Fast Take Chances based on the Roland Sands t-shirt, several other designs. I believe there's another motorcycle podcast that also uses Ride Fast Take Chances, but being that podcasting wasn't around in 1984, I'm going to say City Bike actually is The Real Ride Fast Take Chances. So if you say Ride Fast Take Chances and you are not part of what City Bike is or was, you are the fake Ride Fast Take Chances. You're part of the problem, people.
That's all I wanted clarification on.
Okay. So yeah, that Instagram is The Real Ride Fast Take Chances. We also actually have a website, ridefasttakechances.com. And the website is basically going to be a photo blog of these adventures, probably bits of writing. I'm hoping to get Serge to be able to put down some of his thoughts. I know you're listening, Serge, so this is actually just a hint to you. Get that sassy little keypad of yours up and start typing some stuff out now, damn it. Speaking of adventures, or back to adventures, I should say. So wait, there were whales in Baja. What was there anything else of note that we need to hear about?
There were some bike issues. Very easy, quick fixes.
Okay.
So one rider had actually not ridden her motorcycle since the last time we were in Baja. And so she rebuilt her car before the trip and trailered it down. We had to get some air pressure in the tires. And we were riding for a few hours. We stopped for lunch. And then we start, you know, really kind of booking it because we got to get to our accommodations for the night before sundown. Big rule of thumb down there is you don't want to be on the roads after dark. What actually happens is, especially in the more isolated sections of road, is the desert gets cold at night. So the animals come from the desert and lay on the pavement. And there's no lights. There's no guardrails. It's pretty fucking dark down there. So you could very quickly come across a large animal that you don't want to hit with your motorcycle.
And that probably doesn't give a fuck that you're coming.
Definitely doesn't give a fuck. And then there's drunk drivers. There's a whole slew of reasons you don't want to be on the road after dark.
Fair enough. That's an easy decision.
Super easy. So we left lunch in Ensenada and we're heading further south. And we get through our first military checkpoint, which are throughout the peninsula. And I never have issues. The soldiers are always very friendly, generally more interested, especially when it's a group of women motorcyclists.
Using that to your advantage, I see.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, take the perks where you get them.
Fair enough.
And so I was leading the group and we make it through the checkpoint A-OK. And then I see that there are two riders who haven't followed us. So I pull over on the side of the road, which is now going uphill, starting to get a bit twisty, and there's really no shoulder. So I'm waiting there for a little while and they're still not coming. And at this point, I'm getting mad at the soldiers at the checkpoint because in the past, they've stopped the last rider in the group, even though they've let all of the other riders go. So I thought it was a similar situation, but when I turned my bike around, I went back down to see what was going on. And one of the rider who had rebuilt the carb, her bike wasn't running at all. And so I listened to what she had to tell me and obviously still tried to start the bike myself so that I could get a general idea of what was going on. What did this sound like?
Standard mechanic procedure. Oh, it won't start? Let me try to start it. Oh, it's doing the same thing for me it did for you.
And I knew it would. I didn't think that I'd be able to start it.
No. I'm a mechanic. I'm clearly more qualified to push that start button than you are. When I push it, different things happen.
Exactly. And I laughed at myself as I was doing it. But I wanted to hear what was going on. Was it a battery issue? Was it a bike issue? Was it an engine issue? And it really wanted to turn over, but it wasn't. And so I tried giving it gas. It still wasn't turning over. And at this point, I'm thinking, oh, well, she just rebuilt her carb. And fuck, we got to take this whole thing apart on the side of the road. And I go to the most extreme possible option.
It's never easy.
It was so easy.
What was the
point? It was just the idle. The idle needed adjusting. It was really, really easy.
But, I mean,
luckily, we didn't tear into it.
Good, good. All right, so crises averted, idle issues.
Crises
fixed.
Averted. And then the other bike maintenance that came up was on our longest day, it was over 300 miles. We wanted to get an early start. This time of year, the sun goes down earlier, so there's less daylight. And on our way out of town, I was going to skip getting gas because we still had enough gas to get us to the next gas station. But the one rider flagged down from behind and motioned that they wanted to stop at the gas station. So we pulled over and we stopped at the gas station and her tire pressure light was blinking. So we take a look and it turns out she had a really big, really big nail in the tire. So we pull it out and we plug it, but there's still a small leak, a slow leak on it. And the wonderful thing about Baja is that there's a million tire shops all throughout the peninsula. So after we plugged the tire, we rode less than a kilometer. We passed, I think, three tire shops on our way before getting to the one that we got to. And that tire shop mechanic was used to working on motorcycles. So he had the tire off, the wheel off, within a minute.
That was a GS, right?
Yes.
Single-sided swing arm.
The 700.
Okay.
Yeah. I think
700's got two side. Doesn't matter.
No, it had two. It had two.
It was a two-sided swing arm. Oh wow, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And still getting the wheel off that quick.
He got it off. So I was blown away at how fast he was. I feel like he should definitely be one of those race day mechanics that changes the tires.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Very impressive. So he had the wheel off very quickly. He had the tire off the wheel very quickly, put a patch on it, and everything back on, ready to go.
That's awesome.
And it was cheap, too. What would that run you at a BMW shop here in the States?
Probably $150-$200. But no, let's rephrase that. The BMW dealership is not going to patch your tire. Let's be clear. This is America. We have liabilities. The BMW dealership, it's $200 for a new tire and $150 to pull the tire and wheel off the bike.
Want to guess how much it costs down in Mexico?
I'm going to say $50.
120 pesos.
Okay.
I generally put the conversion, I think it's around 17 or 18 per US dollar. So I round up to 20. So if you divide that by...
That's $5.
Yep.
Okay. All right, I'm moving to Mexico tomorrow.
Yeah, so if you need any tire work done.
I mean, it's 700 miles or so to get there.
Only.
Okay, yeah, that's totally reasonable. Yeah, definitely.
What you save in tire repair, you spend in gas.
I mean, as long as you're, yes, okay, fair enough. we're going to get into your new motorcycle here soon, because I want to talk more about your CB500, and that bike's going to come up in this podcast more. Long-term plans are?
Build it the fuck out. Oh, that's short-term plans. Long-term plans are to ride it.
Okay, so define building the fuck out.
Putting quite a bit of money into upgrades on the suspension, on the wheels, on the handlebars, on the foot pegs. Got to figure out the luggage on that one as well.
And what year is this? It's a CB500X?
CB500X. 2014?
Okay. So, yeah, I think you were talking about the Rally Raid kit, if I remember correctly. And that kit, I forget, is it a 19 or 21 inch front wheel that comes in the kit? Do you remember?
I don't. I think it's 21. I don't know.
Honda just for this year released the same bike now with a 19 inch front wheel. So it's really on par with the BMW GS.
Then it's 19, I think, because I remember reading something about how it's interchangeable with the newer years.
Oh, great. Yeah, because the your bike has a 17-inch front wheel. Still, really, I'm excited about that bike. I think it's going to be pretty awesome.
I can't wait. And it was great to take that bike on this trip to get a feel for it. I've been on this same BMW for 3 or so years.
Okay.
I've gotten very comfortable with it, and I love when I get to try new bikes because I feel like it makes my riding better. And it was great to kind of get acquainted with this bike and see what it's really good at and see what I want to change about it to make it better.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that feeling, although my last... two new motorcycles have been the same model as the previous one. So I don't even bother test riding it. I just buy they're all Buell Ulysses, and like I buy the Buell, I put it in the truck, I bring it home, I take the parts that I store from one Buell to another, and then go on about my day. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So adventures. I myself also returned from adventure.
Where were you?
An event known as King of the Hammers takes place in Johnson Valley, California, which is kind of outside Yucca Valley, south of Barstow. So if that's not nowhere, I don't know what is. I've been going to King of the Hammers for about 4 years now. And the first and second years that I went were, they also had an event there called King of the Motos. My purpose for being there was working with an automotive team running what they call an Ultra 4 truck. I won't bore you with all of those details. But King of the Motos captured my imagination because they run on the same rock trails that the King of the Hammers trucks do, which are near as makes no difference impassable for mere mortals.
You sent me the video. It's fucking insane.
Yeah, these guys are riding motorcycles up boulders and through rock paths.
And they all take off. They all took off at the same time, too.
Yeah, they are. Land rush starts.
Holy shit. How many people get... How bad are the injuries there?
I don't... This year was particularly... brutal does not begin to describe it. The results are on Ultra 4. So Ultra 4 is the... promoting body, and the results from this year are on their Instagram and their website. The race breaks down, so they have three laps. There is a bronze lap, a silver lap, and a gold lap. The gold lap is for pros only, and everything else is open to amateurs. So they did a land rush start, and I think there were only three or four finishers of the gold lap. They started with 150 entrants. I think only a third of the people completed the first lap.
Whoa. Wait, how many people finished?
Three.
Of?
150.
Holy shit.
This race, I believe this race was originally conceived by Jimmy Lewis, who is a Dakar racer and motorcycle instructor. It's my understanding that Jimmy ran the course this year, but it was actually... managed and run and designed by a gentleman named Justin Lineweber, who is an AMA guy from Southern California. The hard enduro is a sort of a trending thing lately. They're hair scramble enduro races with nearly impossible obstacles. It's certainly powered the resurgence of two-stroke motorcycles because a lot of these guys are carrying their motorcycles up these rock obstacles.
Oh, wow. Are they riding regular motorcycles or are these trials bikes?
They are regular motorcycles. Usually the descriptions on the website have sort of varied over the years, but they typically say they underscore that you need a cross country bike because it's about 100-mile lap. So you need to carry, I think, 5 or 6 gallons of gasoline with you.
Mm-hmm.
Your bike needs to be stable to idle and rock crawl, essentially. So it has to have cooling fans over the radiators. It can't be like a motocross bike. It needs to have a fair amount of torque and low RPM tractability, but still be able to traverse the desert sections reasonably.
So are all the bikes that compete custom?
They are production-based bikes. I don't think there's a lot of modifications. The guy who was declared the winner this year and won has been a previous winner. His name is Cody Webb. Cody is superhuman, nothing short of amazing. The kind of guy that can load his truck into the back his truck, load his motorcycle into the back of a pickup truck without a ramp.
I feel like you've told me about that. That's the practice for this event.
Yeah. So this year was his first year riding a Sherpa, which is a sort of boutique European motorcycle. You see a lot of KTMs, a lot of Betas. Those brands seem to really dominate this racing. And it's all based on lightweight two-stroke cross-country motorcycles. I think there were a couple four-stroke bikes, but I admittedly didn't spectate as closely as I should have. It's overwhelming to be at the area. The Johnson Valley OHV Park is just a massive expanse. It's a former bomb test range, so there are bomb craters. There are two or three different dry lake beds in this area. There's sand dunes, there's rock hills, there's rock crawling obstacles, there's flat desert with whoops. I mean, you name it. The terrain is everywhere. Hammertown this year, this was the Burning Man of off-road events. There were over 80,000 people on the lake bed.
That's a lot. And that's for, they did the truck and the motorcycle racing.
It is a week-long event of motorsports paranoia. I don't know. Pandemonium. Motorsports pandemonium. The event kicks off with UTV races, which UTVs have pretty much exploded, and the capability of these vehicles are now just mind-bending. They run a UTV race. I believe that happens on Monday. Sunday is UTVs. Monday is qualifying for the Everyman Challenge, which are off-road racing trucks and buggies and those kind of vehicles that can be built out of street-going vehicles. So they're not supposed to be tube-frame chassis. They're supposed to be production-based trucks. They qualify Monday. Tuesday is Ultra 4 qualifying, and Ultra 4 is unlimited four-wheel drive racing. It has to be a four-wheel drive truck, and it's unlimited. Most of these trucks are 600 to 800 horsepower. They can do 100-plus miles an hour on the desert, and they can easily traverse a six-foot rock ledge, what's known as a waterfall-type obstacle. Some of them are four-wheel independent suspension. Some are front independent. Some of them are solid axle both ends. It's unlimited, and it's amazing. So those guys qualify on Tuesday. Wednesday is what they call the Everyman Challenge race, where those production-based trucks race. Thursday is the Toyo Tires Desert Invitational, where they run T1-style trophy trucks across this lake bed with a few technical sections but no rock obstacles. Friday is the Ultra 4 race, and then Saturday is the King of the Motos.
Okay, so so they all have their own day.
They all have their own complete day.
That's great. One of the things that I've seen with the Baja races is they all go the same day, and they'll send certain groups out before other groups.
Yeah. Yours truly thought about doing a Baja race on my trusty CRF 250L.
Mm-hmm.
And spoke to a gentleman who said, if you're on a motorcycle that can outrun a trophy truck, you will die. He said it's literally one of the most terrifying things in the world because the trophy trucks don't see you.
Mm-hmm.
And they are doing 130, 100 and something like that across the desert, and they will run you over. And the noise they make is earth-shaking. It is so amazing. So the staged start time of Baja is...
Motorcycles first.
Yeah, so you're going to get run down by a trophy truck if you're not on your game. That was one of the things. I think like the whole week of camping, and I think they charge you $30 to spectate, and then it's an additional $20 if you bring an RV. So if you're tent camping, it's free. It's just $30 to spectate. And there is, I mean, civilization, they call it Hammer Town. It is similar to Burning Man that there is infrastructure. Like there's internet. There are Jumbotrons. The only difference is now there are Jumbotrons. There are helicopters giving you live feed of the race. So you can camp out next to the group communal fire pit in Hammertown and watch the race on a Jumbotron. You can go get a hamburger, walk over and get a beer, and then decide to jump in your friend's car and have him drive you out to one of the particular rock obstacles in the middle of the race. So you can watch it on a Jumbotron or you can watch it live.
That's really neat. Do folks tend to stay the whole week, or they'll come and go?
It's usually a week thing. It sort of culminates. I personally showed up on Wednesday morning, so I got to watch the Everyman race. But there are people that are out there a week before and stay a week after. A lot of people take their personal vehicles and go four-wheeling, check out the area. Then they watch the racing, and then they go four-wheeling after the racing.
And that's you did that, right? What did you bring with you this year?
I actually just brought my 71 Land Rover, which is outdated, slow, but surprisingly rugged.
And did you do any of the course with that? Do you have access to the course?
The course is closed down during the races, obviously. And no, there were no part of the rock obstacles that I was taking the Land Rover over. I did drive it in some of the desert sections, but... something about not having 14 inches of suspension means that going 25 miles an hour felt really fast.
Yeah, I could see that.
I have in previous years taken my motorcycle and chased some of the trucks to take pictures. as a matter of fact, if you go to citybike.com and search King of the Hammers, you'll see some of the stories from there and some of the pictures I've taken previous years. But the pictures from this year will be up on our website. So... That was my adventure. At some point, we should talk about the adventure you had with your the adventure that spawned the idea for the CB500X. Was that when you were up in Occidental chasing Tom Waits?
Oh, Tom Waits. Yeah, it was when my bike killed itself, attempted to kill itself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, water pump seals are a thing.
says you.
I mean, chocolate milkshake oil is also a thing, apparently.
Yes, it is. We should put that picture up. That was a gnarly looking mixture.
That'll be there on the website too. So yeah, the website, again, will just be a photo blog of most of these things that you're hearing about. We also upcoming have an interview with a group of people out of Baltimore. You want to tell us more about that, Carrie?
Yeah. So I had the opportunity to interview Brittany, who started and runs B360, which is a nonprofit organization that has a STEM education program that works with youth in Baltimore City and relates the dirt bike culture of that city in a really incredible, empowering way. So I had the opportunity to interview her earlier this week, and you and I will listen to that interview and then share our thoughts on that organization and what they're doing.
And I look forward to that. Pop quiz, what does STEM mean?
Well, Fish, let me tell you.
I'm listening.
It means...
Carrie does great with pop quizzes.
I can't even get it out. It means science, technology, engineering, and math.
All right. Which, by the way, are subjects that are not particularly taught well in those neighborhoods, so it has a lot of meaning to me personally.
Well, and I think it's the taught well part. I think further exploring that is more about taught in a way that's useful to people, because you can sit in the classroom all day and learn all of these absurd things having to do with science, technology, engineering, and math, but how does that apply to your life and how can that help you?
Yeah, I mean, learning languages are something that we're still just touching the surface of.
Yeah. Well, and so my interview with Brittany was really great to kind of explore those things a little bit better.
Speaking of learning languages, you have another career that you should enlighten us a bit about. You work with the California Motorcycle Safety Program.
Oh, I do. I teach new students how to ride. I teach the beginner course on the weekends.
So, what do you think about motorcycle, like the learning language of teaching people to ride a motorcycle? Have you gleaned anything from that?
Keep it short, keep it basic. A lot of times students are very nervous. They're in their head a lot. So the less words you use and the clearer and more concise you are, the better and easier it is for the student. One of the things that I learned through becoming certified to be an instructor is there's a lot of work, a lot of invisible work that the instructors are or should be doing, depending on who, the instructor, I suppose, to help alleviate that stress for the student and make it a much better environment, easier environment for them to learn safer and more effectively.
So pop quizzes are not high on the list of things you should be doing while you're teaching learning to ride motorcycles?
No, pop quizzes are not. Although sometimes you'll have a student who's so overwhelmed, they don't even remember having learned what a throttle is in the classroom before you have them out on the range. And that can sometimes be a little concerning.
Yeah, the throttle is, in my opinion, the most important part of a motorcycle. I mean, I kind of live by the slogan that if you're ever in a problem, you should apply throttle because it'll either solve it or end the suspense.
And I think when riding on the road, that's one way to deal with it. But with students, you got to be patient. Try and pick up a clue.
That's good advice.
Yeah, I learned that one from a really smart man.
A fountain of wisdom, you would say?
Total fountain of wisdom.
Getting to know us more. Beyond adventures and tangents and pictures of adventures and probably pictures of tangents, let's be realistic here. The upcoming, as we talked about, Project CB500X with the Rally Raid kit will be something we're going to discuss. Additionally, I personally have what might as well be considered a fleet of motorcycles that will receive a fair amount of attention One bike that I would like you to all get to know personally is my 1979 Harley-Davidson FXE. I come to you as a Harley-Davidson owner, but not necessarily a Harley-Davidson fan.
Why is that bike so important?
This particular motorcycle belonged to my father's best friend, who my father named me after. He purchased the bike in, near as I've been told, 1981 or so. And then my dad and his friend rode their motorcycles, my friend, his friend on this bike, to Sturgis. And upon returning from Sturgis in 1983, the engine needed some repair work. Harley had a flawed design in their valve guide.
Harley doesn't have any flaws.
Yes, that's right. Sorry.
Hold your tongue.
Somehow, yes, I apologize. I will not blaspheme. So the valve guides needed to be repaired in the cylinder heads. So my dad pulled the heads off of this bike for his friend and repaired the valve guide that had failed and upgraded the valve guide in the valve guides in the other cylinder. And my friend had continued to ride that bike. I think it had 20,000 miles on it at that point. It now has about 48,000 or so. But the bike has an interesting story. My dad's friend lived in Washington, originally Oregon, then Washington, and then Boston, and he finally settled in Florida. And he sadly passed away going on 5 years ago, I think. But the bike had been in his storage barn in Florida for upwards of 10 years, where then when he passed away, the bike was willed to my father, who picked it up and let it sit in his garage for another 2 years. And then I went to Oregon because it was supposed to be eventually willed to me. I picked it up from my father, where then it sat at my house for another year or so. And then I was looking at it, and every single surface had rust on it. The paint was flaking from the engine cases. There wasn't, all of the hoses were dried and cracked. The fuel had sat in the tanks so long, and particularly in the hose between the fuel tank and the carburetor, that it had digested that hose and turned the hose into a gelatinous goo that was then stuck as a paste onto the primary case of the engine. Yes, I scraped it off with a flathead screwdriver, and it came off like chewing gum.
Oh.
So that bike, I was looking at it, and I just decided it needed to be completely torn down and rebuilt. But my dad and I were conversing about the parts I would need and what gaskets I should get beforehand. And he suggested I just see if it would run.
With that gummy?
So he said I should clean the fuel tank, clean the carburetor, and see if it would run. But in order to do that, I did actually have to replace some of the oil lines between the oil tank and the primary and the oil tank and the fuel pump. Oil tank and oil pump. So with 5 foot of oil line, a couple feet of fuel line, $100 carburetor kit, I started the bike up and it ran.
How did it run or did you ride it? Have you ridden it?
Because it started and ran, I have since taken a few other things apart and cleaned them, but I've not actually taken any of the parts off of the engine aside from the carburetor and the primary system, because one of the oil lines actually goes to the inside of the primary chain case, which it's a design Harley doesn't do anymore, but this bike had what they call a dry clutch and a wet primary. So the oil would drip onto the primary chain and then be scavenged by the oil pump and pumped back into the tank. And the oil feed line for that was dry and cracked. So I had to pull the primary off to replace that. But no major engine service. And it did develop a fork leak, which I then fixed with a Motion Pro Seal Saver. Thank you, Motion Pro.
Those are great.
I mean, $6 versus replacing a fork seal. I can't argue with that.
Yeah.
And I did put a new set of tires on it. Although, at my dad's advice, the bike had been stored indoors, and the tires had plenty of tread. So there was no reason to replace them. Never mind them being produced in 1994, I believe.
No, they're fine. They got a ton of tread left.
So I replaced the tires on it. And I've been riding it around. And it's shockingly not awful. I think is the brakes are truly some of the worst stopping power I've ever experienced. The dual 10-inch discs are basically like rubbing wood on the asphalt to try to slow down.
Is there a way to change those or upgrade those?
Yes, Harley's braking systems got better, but part of the charm of that bike is that it's pretty much as parked in the mid-90s. It's truly a time capsule 80s shovel head, and I just get on it, kick it, and I go places sometimes. It is really comfortable. I have to give Harley credit. The buckhorn-style handlebars put your wrists at a shockingly relaxed angle.
Maybe I'll put those on my Honda when I do
If you do, you're out of the podcast. That's it.
Man.
No Harley handlebars on your Honda. If you do that, it will start leaking oil.
Instantly.
Which, by the way, I do need to point out, one of the best features of the Harley shovel head was the built-in oil leak. The bike is designed to drip oil onto the chain, so you don't have to oil your final chain. But part of the caveat to that is that the bike is designed to consume at least one quart of oil every 500 miles. It says so in the owner's manual.
That's not very conducive to my life.
You just carry oil with you. It's fine.
And just keep pouring it in.
Just pour it in. You never have to change it.
Spills all over the...
I mean, it's a fine mist. In my younger years, when I rode other Harleys with exposed primary chains, in addition to having an exposed drive chain, the left side of every piece of clothing that I wore was soaked in oil. It was a fine mist being flung from the chain. So when I would ride in the rain, the left side of my body, the rain would actually bead on my jeans.
It was rainproofing for your safety gear.
I was wax cotton before wax cotton was cool. I have half wax cotton Harley t-shirts. I was a pioneer. I would love to get emails from people and hear more stories about what motorcycling was in the 70s and 80s. I'm aware of total loss oiling systems. If you've ever watched Jay Leno ride his Brough Superior, the engine, there is a knob and it actually drips oil on some of the wear points that are exposed. But there is additionally a little thumb pump that you are advised to push every, I don't know the number of miles or time, while you're riding in extreme conditions, that literally just squirts extra oil onto the outside of the engine. And you just top the oil up while you're riding the motorcycle. It's part of gas.
While you're riding or once it's parked?
When you are topping up with fuel, you are also required to top up with oil.
Okay.
So I know total loss oiling systems are a thing, but the fact that the Japanese were producing sealed engines that didn't coat your body in motor oil in 1969, but Harley still felt appropriate to carry that trend on clear to 1984, I think, 1983. I can poke fun at the company all the time, but the other side of that is there's not a lot of people who have a hand-me-down CB750, and I do really cherish the bike, and I'm pretty excited to have it as part of my fleet.
Yeah, that's a pretty incredible backstory on it, and you being named after him, and all of that is very touching, Fish.
I mean, this is like one of the few soft sides of me. You won't see that often. And then aside from that, there's the saga of the many Buells, which I'd love to also get into later at some point. Do we have any other friends who ride Buells?
No.
At least no one who will admit it in public?
Actually, you know who I've heard compliment Buells is Emily Roberts. And she is the woman I met at the Touratech rally in June. I think she's around my age, and she'll be joining me on the Belize tour I'm running in March. And she'll definitely be a guest on this podcast. She's a pretty kick-ass woman.
Is she going to be down before you go to Belize?
She lives in Canada. I think she'll be passing through California in July, though.
Okay. Because, yeah, like, I would love to... I need to share my Buell saga with someone who is sympathetic to my plight.
And maybe we could figure out a way to do an episode while her and I are in Belize and you call that, in and...
Yes. I mean, at the very least, I'm going to send you to Belize with a recorder. Believe that.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So anyways, that's the long and short of it. I hope to also bring you guys a bit of gear reviews, and Carrie and I will probably be reviewing some new motorcycles if it works out and the cards come in our favor. Maybe not. They have to make motorcycles that I want to ride anymore. I think that's one of the things that I'd like to carry over from City Bike directly.
So only bikes that you want to ride?
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I was really, really happy that I rode the GSX 250R, I think was Suzuki's bike. That bike, I'm glad I rode it. It's not one I would have picked up. However, if I never, ever, ever ride any of Suzuki's GSX-S or Kawasaki's Z series motorcycles, the Z650 or the Z900, I'm okay with that.
I think what I'm guessing would be your favorite experience would be the Monkey and Catalina.
Honda generously put me on a helicopter and took me to Catalina Island to ride the Honda Monkey.
Did you hear that they're doing those races on Catalina Island again?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, this is that face.
This is my jealousy and bitter grumpy voice. Let me be perfectly clear. I was not invited to ride my motorcycle on Catalina Island, and I don't get to race the Catalina GP.
Well, then fuck it.
Yeah, fuck that place. They can fuck off. Until they figure out how to get Buells involved in their race, they can fuck off.
We also have a website you can go check out.
Yes, I mentioned earlier, ridefasttakechances.com.
You did mention that.
I did. I'm mentioning it again because I really want you to check it out. And also, I think it's obligatory. Everyone who has a podcast, we need to ask you to go to Apple iTunes and give us 5 stars. I hear that you don't actually have to say anything. You can say, they told me to say this, or that you like tacos. Speaking of which, I like tacos, and I assume I am in the great state of California, so I assume it's like a given that I like tacos.
You know, I don't eat meat, so tacos can be a little... I get picky. I'm more of a pupusa kind of girl myself.
I'm not going to argue that point. That's fair. I am the resident carnivore, and I'm shameless about it. Comment and say what kind of whiskey or hard spirit that you like, or if you hate alcohol.
I hate alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol is evil. Don't tell, whatever, just go in and give us 5 stars. What it does is it puts us in some sort of algorithm, and then more people listen to us, and it'll be good for everyone. Then I can sit here and complain more, and that's really what you want to hear is me complaining and Carrie egging me on.
Exactly.
All right. With that, thank you for listening to our first episode. Carrie, thanks for taking the time to actually do this with me. I'm truly honored to have you as a partner in this venture.
I am so excited and honored to have you as a partner with this. I enjoy your company. I enjoy your wealth of knowledge and your sense of humor. So I think, and your riding skills. So I think this is going to be a great fucking time.
Fuck yeah, it is. All right, guys. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.